In this two-part conversation, I discuss civilizationalism as a new force in global politics with Anvesh Jain. Part 1 covers the western half of Eurasia, the West and Russia, while Part 2 covers the eastern half of Eurasia, India and China. In Part 1, we discuss the rise of civilizationalism across the world, civilizationalists as alternative intellectuals, the ignorance of elites on the movement's appeal, Russia as a Eurasian civilization, whether Russia is the true inheritor of the Roman Empire, why Western civilizationalists admire Russian conservatism today, whether civilizations threaten the principle of equality in international relations, why Western civilization is shared among many states, the goal of civilizationalism, its cyclical time spans, and many more topics. And now, a little about my guest. Anvesh Jain is an international affairs analyst and a JD candidate at the University of Ottawa. He recently published a paper titled Comparing Civilization State Models, China, Russia, India, in the peer-reviewed Journal of Indo-Pacific Affairs. Anvesh has also published for the Macdonald Laurier Institute, the Stimson Center, the Hill Times, and the Mackenzie Institute, among other outlets. Anvesh is part of the NATO Association of Canada and is an emerging scholar at the Network for Strategic Analysis at Queen's University. You can connect with him on LinkedIn or discover more of his work on his website at anveshjain.com. And now I bring you Anvesh Jain. People in policy really want to make an impact, and our world needs them to succeed now more than ever. Why then, despite all our technology, are people in policy still siloed in clusters? Policy researchers lack a shared space to connect beyond their tanks. Their research struggles for attention on social media, where shallow content dominates. People in policy need their own platform, where they can connect and think outside the tank together. Welcome to Policy People. We are an online community that connects you with the people you need to succeed in policy and make a real impact on our world. And this is the Policy People Podcast. Civilizationalism, the West. I am here with Anvesh Jain. Anvesh, welcome to the Policy People Podcast.
Thank you for having me on, Liam.
Thank you so much, Anvesh. I am so excited because you are a civilizational thinker, and this is a topic that I've been really excited to get into with you today because you've written a very powerful article for the Journal of Indo-Pacific Affairs. We've previously had the chief editor of that journal, Dr. Ernest Gunasekara Rockwell, on the show. And he spoke so highly of your work. And after reading it myself, I've got to say, Anvesh, like, this is just such a fresh, interesting perspective that you're giving us here. And it's not just about the Indo-Pacific, lest listeners misunderstand. You're really talking about a broader shift in terms of how we think about international relations and, I guess, regionality. There's so much packed into it, civilizational sort of discourse and this shift in this direction into the 21st century. And what could it all mean for us?
Well, once again, Liam, thank you for having me on and for all the flattery and all of that, both from Doc and from you. And I'm very glad that I have an opportunity to talk about this article. And I think you're asking really good questions here. Why should people in policy care about civilizationalism? I think we have to care because other people care, because people who are out in the world, who are making these changes in these other countries, they're looking at this ideology, they're looking at these undercurrents, and this is something that guides them. These are principles that they are thinking about, that they are elaborating on, and it is something that is out there in the world that is kind of beyond our policy space. And that's one of the focuses of my article. It's that a lot of this thinking isn't being articulated in the formal sector. It's not happening in university articles. It's not happening in the famous, you know, top 50, top 100 policy journals. It's happening out there in the real world among real people and this second alternative intellectual class. So one of the reasons that we in our policy sphere have to care is because this is a force. It exists in the world. It's out there. We can't run from it or retreat from it. And if we don't reckon with this kind of thinking that is out there and being articulated, our policy-making space is going to be smaller, our room for understanding will be lesser, and our ideation and analyses are just simply going to be incomplete. So it's not about accepting or rejecting this kind of discourse. It's about analyzing it and making sure that we're incorporating it into our thinking. Because you can't have complete strategy, you can't have complete policy without actually looking at how the other is thinking. How are these other people out there in the world? How are they exhibiting, you know, their ideas and thoughts in the realm of their policy universes? And how can we bring those universes together?
That's brilliant.
So I think that's one of the reasons why we have to care. Another reason is that civilizationalism, thank you. Another reason is because this civilizationalism that we're talking about, it doesn't just manifest out in the East. It's not, I know my article, as we're going to delve into, it talks about Russia, it talks about China, it talks about India in particular. But as I've noted in the intro and conclusion, this line of thinking, it's not just out East, it's not just in these countries that, you know, they're rising powers and we think about them. It's here in our own societies as well. It's here in the West. So this is a quote from my article, and I'd like to read it out. But this is one of the succinct reasons why we have to care about it as well. It is necessary that we do not retreat from these ideations or dismiss them as the preserve of two big dictators and dogmatic imperialists. This is doubly so as such language, civilizational language, has found reverberation in Western circles, as espoused by French President Emmanuel Macron or former American President Donald Trump, who in a 2017 speech queried to the Polish people on a visit there, do we have the desire and the courage to preserve our civilization in the face of those who would subvert and destroy it? So what I'm trying to say, Liam, is that this line of thinking, whether we like it or not, whether we reject it or not in some of our insulated policy circles here in the West, it exists out in the world and in our own societies as well.
I have a quick follow-up question then. Why?
Sure.
Why is it taking us so long to wake up and recognize this force?
Yeah, so I think there's two reasons primarily. One is that this is a critique I have of Western, and not just Western, to be quite honest, just academic institutions in particular. They can be very insulated from how common people think and how common people function.
Elitist.
It can be kind of elitist in a lot of ways. A lot of the, what I've noticed is that when you get into academia, some of the trends that are existing, you're almost analyzing them 5 or 10 years too late because you need to wait until a literature has been built up. You need to wait until very established voices in the field have talked about it or written their articles or gone on, you know, their podcasts and all these things and discuss these ideas. And then finally, you have an opportunity to sit down and say, ah, we have a historiography here. We have a literature here. We can begin to talk about this. And by the time you're talking about it, you're 10 years out of date. Your analysis is already, you know, it's out in the past and the real world has moved on. And this is not necessarily a critique of all the people in academia, but I just think that these institutions can be very insular. They can move very slowly, too slowly. And a lot of this thinking, as I've said, is being articulated outside of the formal space. And sometimes the people who are doing this thinking, they don't have the academic credentials. And academics have a bad habit of not listening to people who don't have, you know, a string of alphabet letters after their title, you know, PhD, MD, BA, whatever, all these things. So sometimes I think people have a hard time listening to these thoughts and ideas that are animating regular people. One of the things I talk about in the article is how many of these people are, you know, they're not academics, they're business people, they work in government, they work in think tanks, they write in the popular press, they are journalists, they are thinkers, they are people who are out on the circuit, they are politicians a lot of the times. I know we all have our disdain for politicians, but their ideas, the things that they talk about, these are principles that animate and move societies. So one of the reasons why I think we're missing out on this discourse is because we're simply not tapping into it. Another big reason is that it's often happening for a different audience. It's happening in vernacular languages. So you're not going to see the most forceful articulations of civilizational thinking. Let's say, because if you're in China, or if you're in India, if you're in Russia, you are not talking to a Western audience.
No.
You are not talking even to, you know, the Westernized English-speaking elite who exist in your universities, who exist as your elite upper crust of society, the established class. Who in their own business connections, in their own academic life, they have to rely on the West. I bring up the example of, let's say, academics in India who are maybe in Delhi University or in a university in Mumbai or BBC journalists or whoever, who their gaze, who they are writing for, who they are appealing to, is not to, you know, people in their own country or people who are speaking these vernacular languages. It's to people who exist and reside in the West. It's for their credentials. You know, you have to establish these things.
Of course.
And as a result, you're losing touch with, I think, a lot of the audience and the people in your own country. And this is the people who, this is the gap that the civilizationalists are filling in. So I know you have a question about this later, but we're talking about two competing concepts of intellectualism, of elitism. So there is a westernized elite that exists in these countries, and we'll dive into this in a second. And there is a non-westernized elite that is articulating these ideas and talking to people who we are not talking to, who we are not seeing out in the world. So this kind of discourse, it's probably happening in Hindi. It's probably happening in Marathi or Tamil or Gujarati. It's happening in Chinese and Cantonese, in Mandarin or Cantonese. It's happening in Russian languages. So as a Western policy audience, maybe we're not tapping into these languages because we're just it's not in our radar. It's not in our world.
Yes.
And the kind of sources, English language sources that we might be used to accessing from these countries, they might be speaking to us as an audience and not necessarily to the people who the civilizationalists are speaking to.
Yes.
So that's a second reason. And I have a third and final reason why I think we've been missing out on this discourse. It's because really, in my analysis, I trace civilizational thinking back to the fall of the Cold War, the end of the Soviet Union, and the rise of Samuel P. Huntington and his Clash of Civilizations line of thinking. I think his article came out in 1993. Fall of the Soviet Union was 1991. I trace that as the end of ideology as a kind of dividing or bifurcating principle in the world. So suddenly countries are not looking at themselves as communists, as socialists, as liberals, as Democrats, whatever. These ideologies are still there, but there is suddenly not a contestation or a tension between them. One ideology has clearly won out, and you can see that in very gloating articles like Francis Fukuyama's The End of History. People in the West, they believe that they've won, that the race is over, that there is one liberal democratic ideology that will spread around the world and everybody will be free, war will be over, we'll have an interconnected global economy. And 30 years later, we are seeing that that line of thinking just didn't pan out.
Of course, yeah.
So
we can let that one go.
The fall of the Soviet Union, the fall of ideology and the rise of people went and they searched for something else. They needed something else to guide them, something to work for towards. And I really think that societies need goals. They need ideas to work towards, and they need projects that are many, many years and decades of thinking or in the process. So I think once ideology was cleared away, you now had a civilizational thinking being introduced into the mainstream thanks to Huntington. But then because of the unipolar moment, because of America's unipolar moment, it was masked away for a while. It was kind of a facade of liberal democracy dominating our global policy space, the unipolar moment for 20, 25 years. And now suddenly, now that we're seeing the United States recede from the world, the space for these other ideas is coming back. That is why, in fact, my article, a lot of the sources that I've used, and I was stunned by this too, because I before I got into the article, I had an interest in civilizational thinking and I wanted to get into it. But when I really got into the weeds and started researching, I found out how recent all of this thinking is. Most of my articles are from 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020. They're not from decades ago. Yeah. It's all very recent.
That's fascinating.
Exciting things that are happening in this space. So I think these are the trends that we're looking at.
Okay, that's very fascinating, Anvesh. That basically points to what you were just talking about. We had this sort of 20, 30-year period of where it was sort of put on hold, and perhaps the Brexit-Trump combo sort of reared its head, and perhaps the there is this other term, you know, sort of alternative intellectual space, or you know, some in the West they have this another version of the intellectual dark web. I think that refers to a different group of thinkers, which we may actually come to later in the conversation, because there could be quite a bit of overlap between them and maybe the sort of the Western version of this. But there's so much I'd love to unpack. But I think you did just a fantastic job of explaining to our audience where the divide is between the civilizationalists and, you know, your typical ivory tower thinkers in academia. I'd now like to look at your article, look at a bit of the methodology here, Anvesh. Okay, because you chose, Russia, China, and India. You wrote about the difficulty of inter-civilizational comparison. Is this why you chose to focus more on researching the processes of civilizational discourse as intellectual movements rather than comparing these three civilizations, sort of kind of lining them up and comparing them on an analytical way? Can you just talk us through that challenge and how you developed a methodology around it?
So I think I'll add one more note, and it does relate to this question as well. It's that civilizational thinking it didn't just pop up in the last 2 or 3 years. It was there all along, but it was an undercurrent. And now what I'm thinking we're seeing is that it's going from the bottom line, and it's becoming the top line as other ideologies, other ways of conceiving the world are receding. And I think we're going to see more and more of this civilizational inquiry come out. And that's actually kind of what prompted my article as well, my paper, is because I've been reading these articles. I've been seeing this line of thinking come out more and more, not just in you know, the formal space that we inhabit, but I'm part of the Indian community. I'm part of the Indian diaspora. I've been reading some of the vernacular that's been going on. I can't read and write Hindi, but I have a better access to kind of these alternative sources that are being spread around in the community, or these alternative currents of intellectualism. And I was seeing this line of inquiry was coming up more and more, the civilization state, civilizationalism. And that led me to wanting to do my article. But as we've talked about, it hasn't been articulated very well in the academic space yet. And I think now is the right time to begin understanding this thinking. It's the right time to begin reckoning with it so that we have a better understanding of it. So what was the reason I went with the kind of comparative model is because I think that every civilization state has to be approached and constituted on its own terms. I don't think they're trying to aspire to universalism. From what I've read, they're very content with reforming the civilizational space within their own sphere and managing interactions between civilizations, but they don't aspire to, you know, if you're an Indian or Russian civilizationalist, you're not saying that your model is going to work for Brazil or Canada or South Africa or Australia, whoever. You're saying our model is Russian. It is based on Russian history. It is based on Russian mores, Russian political organizations and traditions. And it is for Russian people. It is developing a Russian modernity or a Russian conception of modernity. So you aren't trying to spread this model around the world. You're trying to do best for Russia and by Russian people. So this makes it a bit difficult, I think, to go in and really understand the civilization as an easy formula. I think nation states are a lot easier because it's one-to-one-to-one. Everybody is equal in theory, and every nation state is in theory legally the same. Civilization states are a bit different because their constitution, their self-constitution is explicitly different from one another. So what I'm trying to do in this article is I'm trying to take three cases of civilization states that I think currently best embody, there's an established vernacular literature about why these three constitute civilization states. And then what I'm doing is I'm comparing how civilizational thinking percolated within each of these states, what paradigms they moved through. And then I'm looking at the three of them and I'm saying, okay, this is how it happened in Russia. This is how it happened in China. This is how it happened in India. Now, knowing how it happened in these three different cases, we can look at the process, even though the outcomes are meant to be different. They're not trying to have the same civilizational outcome, but the process by which civilizational thinking percolated within these countries, I think there are similarities there. And once we establish those similarities, I think I'm not saying that my article is kind of the end all be all of the field. What I'm hoping to do is contribute to a very nascent field, one that is just coming into its own right now. And I'm hoping that the methodology that I've introduced here, looking at the three processes, trying to compare them, and then looking at what are the similarities? How did civilizational thinking come up in each of these countries? And then we can come up with a generalizable model that we can apply to future cases. So I even identified a few countries I think we can look at in the future. I didn't. My article isn't even meant to go into a deep dive into each of the three countries that I've examined. The whole point is by comparing, we might learn something about the civilizational state phenomenon as a whole. So I've also identified countries like Ethiopia, Tibet, Israel, Greece, all of these countries. I've also mentioned countries that I don't think fit the mold of a civilization state, but that's just my opinion. I think everybody has their own conceptions of what is and what isn't a civilization state. But the idea is that by using the processes that I've identified, using the methodology that I've identified, perhaps we can come up with a more systematic way of assessing the civilization state phenomenon.
I think you've gone about that in a very thoughtful and consistent way, and I think that will definitely contribute to, you know, further inquiry. There are a couple of threads in just what you shared with us, Anvesh, that I feel foreshadow what we're going to delve deeper into in part two of our conversation. So that excites me a lot. One is that dualism between, I guess, what you might say universalist appeal and particularism.
You were just sort of exploring how this is sort of very much leaning into one's own culture and having a few pretensions of universalist appeal. I do have my own opinions on that. We'll have to leave that, you know, to later on in our dialogue. But I'm very excited and intrigued by that. The other one is this idea of the nation state and the civilization state. And you were just sort of playing with that idea at the end. Can anyone be a civilization? I mean, that's sort of the obvious question to ask. And I guess what I'm slightly concerned about is with the Westphalian model, we sort of have this intellectual idea that states are all equal to, regardless of their longevity or their size. Like, it's interesting to note that when we speak of Western civilization or European civilization, we do not really speak of Canadian civilization or Danish civilization. We may speak of American imperialism, but we don't really even say American civilization. So in other words, it is truly a supranational phenomenon among Western countries. Yet if one state, such as Russia or India, is to claim itself as the sole representative of an ancient civilization, and that civilizationalism takes root in the international relations system, Anvesh, well then, won't this pervert the notion of equality between states and lead invariably to greater disharmony? I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I think it would be one... you'd almost have to ask some of the civilizationalists what they think directly. I've just studied a lot of their thoughts and analysis. Sure. But you raise a few interesting points. I think one of the things that we're talking about here is the nominal equality of states between in the current Westphalian model and the nation state model. And I would almost contest that this is a facade. Mm-hmm. I think that, yes, legally states, small states and big states are equal. But as you and I know in the international relations world, great powers have greater responsibilities and greater weight to throw around as well. And I don't think it's really true that true equality under the law exists in the anarchic world of the state system as it is currently. And I think it's a folly to think that, you know, a Guatemala or a Belize or whoever, a Grenada in the Americas has the same say as the United States. History hasn't borne that out. There's been a lot of illegal things being done there. But, technically under international law, we're looking at the South China Sea.
I just have a slight pushback, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Don't you think it's a better world if at least we have that principle? Than
I agree.
Yeah, I guess it feels like if we just sort of all like pull out our civilizational selves and say, well, you know, we are a civilizational state and you're just a regular state. I mean, it just feels like we're getting very explicit about, yes, it is a fundamental truth that in international relations, superpowers trump, you know, tiny island nations. Yeah, but like, I guess to the idealist within me, it feels a little painful. But yes. Yeah, continue. That's
agree.
My feeling.
I agree. It stings. I think equality between states is a wonderful principle. I believe in it. I think that's the way it should be. I live in Canada. I don't think Canada is really a state that can throw its power around. So I think that we benefit from the rules-based international system. I'm a proponent of it. But I think as the realist within me really questions this notion, I think this current system that we have after World War II, a lot of it is based on American idealism. A lot of it is based on American power. And I think as you're seeing that relative power decline, there's going to be space for other systems, other ways of organizing the global power spatial imaginary. And I think that's what civilizationalism comes down to, isn't it? It's a reimagining of this global power space. And so I think it is unfortunately going to happen on some more realist terms. I don't see China or Russia really saying, oh, we have our civilizational ambitions, but, you know, you have this pesky International Criminal Court, or you have the pesky United Nations saying that we can't do this or that or the other. I just don't see it panning out, unfortunately. Regarding your point of why we, you know, Western civilization or European civilization, I think this is actually very interesting. I ran into some articles about the concept of European civilization being framed in the civilizational framework. I think part of it might come down to the scale of these countries. I think Europe has definitely a common history in terms of the amount of warring that they've done, the amount of literature and ideation that they share, even the calmest genesis of their mythologies. I think so much of the civilization state stuff, it comes down to national narratives, it comes down to mythologies, it comes down to the narrative and discursive functions of the civilization. So, I mean, all these European countries, they conceive themselves as coming, they are the heritage of Rome and Greece. They are the heritage of, you know, the Odyssey and Virgil and Dante and all these things. So there's a common thread that binds in Europe. You also have to look at the size that these countries inhabit. Europe can fit easily many times into Russia or China or India. I was just in Europe earlier this month, and you know, you could go from Berlin to Prague to Italy to Croatia in just a day or two. And it would take you a week to travel the length of a place like Russia. So I think this is one reason that we can speak of a European civilization, but maybe not a Danish one or a Polish one or a British one, though people have in the past tried. Regarding Canada, that's an interesting example that you brought up as well. In my article, I'm actually of the belief that New World civilizations, meaning countries like Brazil or the United States or Canada, I don't think that they qualify as civilization states. This is my opinion. I'm very curious to see if somebody, and I think there have been analyses that have tried to make them civilization states. But I just think that they don't have the same claims to an ancient contiguous territory, a common civilization, because they were, I mean, the experience of colonialism, I think, broke that common thread.
For example, of the Aztec, yes, or the Inca.
Exactly. If you still had these countries that were, I think, a majority of the indigenous population that lived there, then maybe you could say that this is a civilization state. It has a common history. It has like an animus, a binding mythology. But I don't see, you know, the Canadian state today does not look at itself as the successor of all the indigenous and First Nations people who lived here before. I don't think the Brazilian or the maybe in Peru, it's a little bit different. I think they play up the Incan aspect a bit more. Sure. But I don't see the modern Mexican state as necessarily claiming with full force that it is the modern day successor of the Aztec Empire or the Zapotecs or whoever, right? But in India and Russia and China and these other countries that we're examining, even a place like Ethiopia or the European countries, Italy, they can qualify because they have this claim to an ancient, unbroken, continuous history and a contiguous territory and a people that have kind of exhibited the same space and literature for so, so many years.
Got it. Well, Anvesh, it's fantastic that you just brought up continuity and over historical time span, because my next question is about Russia. I guess, okay, you speak or you write about Russia, India, and China, three cases in your case study. This episode, we're going to look at, I guess, sort of broadly speaking, the western half of Eurasia, including Russia. Yes. I'm just going to sort of lump it in that the western half, and we're going to discuss why right now. And then in the next episode, we're going to look at India and China. But let's look at Russia and then actually delve a little bit more into contemporary civilizational thinking in the West. But first, the Russian case. Okay, I feel it's fascinating for a few reasons. You speak a lot about, you know, the I believe, what was the term you used? Geophilosophical or geo?
Geosophistry, geopoetics. Yes, interesting one.
Very interesting stuff here. Basically, you know, emphasizing the centrality of the land and the scope and the size of Russia and as a geopolitical space. You know, and I guess it kind of harks back to a lot of that. Is it the Heartland Theory? You know, and there's a little sort of like geopolitical sort of undercurrents to this. But what I really want to ask is ponder this sort of neo-Tsarist claim to being the third Rome, quote unquote. What does this really mean? I mean, considering Russia views Western Europe as having lost its way with liberalism, could we say that Russia imagines itself as, quote unquote, the real West in some sense?
Well, one of the reasons that I find that I delved so deep into this line of civilizational inquiry and thinking is just because I found it fascinating how many fields and realms it encompassed. It wasn't purely geopolitics. It wasn't purely literature or poetry or sociology or any of these things. It was all of them. It touched on so many different aspects to produce this very potent emotional appeal to people who live in these countries, who are raised and inculcated in what I like to call, I think, the worldview, the schema. And I think this is something that international relations, particularly Western theory, it dismisses so easily. The schema, the worldview that people are inculcated in. Ultimately, we are people. Geopolitics is not all structures and theories and ideas. It is people and the ideas that animate them, the things that bind them to one another. So in the Russian case, I really love researching the Russian example. I think the Chinese example was already very well articulated. That one was quite easy to do. The Indian example was closer to home. So I had a lot of my own sources that I could bring to the table. But the Russian one, the sources I found, it was incredible. I had to find a Polish article in a Polish journal and get it translated from a librarian friend of mine. And it turned out to be so fantastic in terms of talking about some of the thinkers in Russia that are influencing these. It's not just politicians, it's clergymen. It's writers. It's people who are business people. It's people who are connected to the government in various degrees. So it encompasses so many different fields. Regarding the third Rome claim, I think I don't know if Russia would consider itself, or Russian civilizationalists would consider itself, the real West. Because in a lot of the ways, one of the one of the reasons they turned to civilizational thinking is because the West rejected Russia. Historically, a lot of Western Europe, a lot of the thinking has constituted Russia as other, as outside, as being beyond European. Mm. Even as Russia tries to be European, even it has modernized itself along European models and mores. And after the shock that was the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, the decline of the Soviet Union, looking at how the Russian economy was shocked, how kind of there's a sense that the West betrayed Russia. And because of that betrayal, that Russia came to the West with open arms after the fall of the Soviet Union. It wanted to create this better, more cooperative world. But the West, it ransacked Russia. It ran roughshod over the politics, the economy of the nation, and had left the country prone to just a massive power vacuum that had to be filled by somebody, a strongman like Vladimir Putin. So there's a sense that Russia had to be restored to its former glory. And it's based on a rejection of the West, that we don't have to try to be like the West. We can be Russian, we can be proudly Russian, and we are explicitly bicontinental. So Russia is not just dependent on what Europe is, it's not just Asia, but yes, it is a Eurasian power.
I totally agree. I guess what I want, maybe I shouldn't say the quote-unquote real West. Mm-hmm. I guess the real question I'm asking is the cultural legitimacy of the Roman Empire. I guess that's sort of what I'm getting at. Now, because it seems that that's so important to their identity, especially with the religious
part of
it.
Yeah. I think so, definitely. There's a lot of references to this Third Rome, this Third Rome Rising concept. And just a quick primer, I think, for our viewers, there's this idea that the original Rome was in of course, the Roman Empire, based out of the city of Rome, Italy. And then when the West Roman Empire fell, you had the capital shifted to Byzantium. And then this is suddenly the seat of Orthodox power in the world. It is, inherited Latin as an administrative and liturgical language. And it was really inherited the legacy of Rome then. So this is the second Rome. And then finally, when Byzantium fell, the third Rome, a lot of people claim the third Rome, but Russia says because of its Orthodox history, because of the Kievan Rus that was formed kind of out of this cultural milieu of Orthodox Christianity and the Byzantine cultural sphere, that Russia, Moscow, has the real claim to being the third Rome now. And I think part of this is based on a very conservative concept of politics about the Orthodox religion itself. This comes up again and again. If you look at even the annexation of Crimea in 2014, a lot of religious imagery has been used to justify that or to conduct outreach to the Orthodox world in Eastern Europe in places like Greece and Serbia. And there's a lot of explicitly religious imagery posing with members of the Orthodox Church, co-opting these kind of religious practices and this civilizational heritage, this patrimony. Mm. So I think this is very much a part of it. Like this concept that the West has kind of lost its way. There's a lot of very conservative concepts regarding homosexuality and LGBTQ rights that a lot of Russian elites have tried to explicitly reject. Yes. And you see this in like their Olympics team. You see this in the laws that they enact against LGBTQ people. And the sense that Western Christianity has kind of fallen, more people aren't attending the church, that the theological doctrines are not based on sound ideas, and that Western liberalism has lost its way because it's leading to this proliferation of just, excessively progressive cultural thought, and it's undermining the moorings of Western civilization. Mm. But that Russia, thanks to its conservative roots, its Orthodox principles, it still stands strong.
Well, that could explain why some of the civilizational thinkers in the West are quite admire Russia, actually. I mean, let's put aside Trump's remark earlier, at the speech of Poland, but, and we're not going to go down the rabbit hole of how, close Trump is to Russia. But before we go to the sort of the contemporary Western scene, which may be more nascent or maybe just different in nature to what's happening in Russia. I just have just sort of trying to flesh out a little bit more of what it means then, to have that strong religious legacy. Because one of the core pillars of Enlightenment thinking is this idea of the separation of state and church, right? So perhaps what maybe Russian civilizationalists think is that, well, with the maintaining of the ongoing upholding of the church's value and its power in society and its close embeddedness with the state, perhaps that is really more what it was like millennia ago, you know, in Roman times. And so that may be a continuing on of that, not just cultural, but political legacy. Whereas in the West, you know, the Catholic Church and the Protestant other denominations have really lost most of their political powers. So, that's just an idea.
So, one of the interesting things, but I don't think it's exactly just trying to throw back Russian society into 1000.
No, I didn't mean to quite put it that way. But yeah.
No. Of course, I don't think anybody's trying to walk around in togas and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I think what they're trying to do, the way I think about it, is that at some point in Russian history, they were going along in each of the civilizations that we're talking about.
Sure.
That they were going along on their own path, that they had their own civilizational trajectory that they were going towards, and suddenly the West came in and disrupted this history. And there's a very clean and fundamental break, and these civilizations are still recovering from that breakage, from that kind of disruption in their civilizational history, their authentic trajectory. And the word that I like to use the most is actually revivalism, because what they are trying to do is revive where they were, what path they were going on before the West intervened and broke everything down. They're trying to create a kind of indigenous or autochthonous political modernity. So they aren't trying to, you know, go back 300 years, but they're saying, okay, 300 years ago, this is where we were at. The West came in, it meddled with us. Or in Russia, there's a concept of shmutis, or kind of breakdowns in the civilizational history. It's a very cyclical view. I found that very interesting. I read about it in the article. But there's this idea that Russian civilization has to recover from these turbulent times, from these episodes of distress and disorder. And the way it does that is by bringing people together, by having a strongman politician, somebody like an emperor or a Vladimir Putin, who can really bring the Russian people forward and have a common rooting and binding. And the idea is that, okay, if we take where we were 300 years ago and we see where we are now, where would Russia have been had we not been meddled with, had we not been interfered with? And this is something that civilizationalists are contending with in every single case. They're asking themselves, what would our authentic political future have been? How can we get back to that trajectory that we lost because of, you know, either in the Indian case, it was the 250, 300 years of colonialism. How can you rectify that in 75 years of independence? You can't. It's a long project.
Yeah.
In China, it's the century of humiliation that they refer to again and again and again. And in Russia, it's this concept of turbulent times, of shmuti, of, as in the recent one that a lot of these Russian civilizational thinkers is referred to is the fall of the Soviet Union. I think Vladimir Putin called it the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century.
Sure.
So there's a concept that from this breakage, we must reemerge and we must revive our civilization.
I guess, would they broadly look, I mean, I'm thinking of thinkers like Alexander Dugin, I hope I'm pronouncing.
Dugin, yes.
He's quite an outspoken thinker there.
Yes.
I mean, because like Stalin and the USSR were definitely not friendly toward Orthodox religion in Russia. So I guess would like that, I mean, that's awkward. Would they see the USSR therefore as an imperfect sort of revisionist attempt that was at least powerful to resist the West, but, you know, did not retain a lot of its original cultural legacy. And so now we have to rebuild sort of, so, you know, Soviet power 2.0, but now with, you know, our history and our culture.
Exactly, Liam. Exactly. I think, I think the cultural legacy you point is so, that you made is so important, because I think all of this comes down to defending one's cultural legacy. This is a point that they bring up in every single example, is that it comes down to culture, it comes down to history. And I think the closest parallel to the modern Russian civilization state that they're trying to create is not actually the Soviet Union, but it's the Tsarist Empire that they had before the Soviet Union, one that had an emperor, one that had a multinational, multi-ethnic, multilinguistic concept of a civilization, of an empire, basically. And that's one of the ideas that they're trying to resurrect. we can't read too much into people like Dugin, because I think he isn't, it's not a one-to-one in terms of they say these things and it's immediately implemented into the policy vision, but it's there, it's part of the milieu. And one of the things that Dugin or Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the famous Russian writer, he has a concept of reunifying places like Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Russia into one country. This is a civilizational way of thinking, and it's not coming from an academic, it's not coming from a professor, it's not coming from, in that case, the prime minister or whoever, the Soviet commissar, or whoever they had back in that time. It was coming from a writer. It is coming from people who are talking to the common people in a common tongue, evoking a common mythological origin and narrative. It is all about narrative.
Well, it's perfect then that we look at someone who was originally in academia, but now has had much more success as a writer. I'm talking about Jordan Peterson, a fellow Canadian of yours,
yes.
Because, you know, a lot of people, in fact, I've seen some biographies of his subtitled, you know, what is it, The Man to Save Western Civilization, or there's a subtitle like that, like this.
Yeah.
Anyway, he and other thinkers in the West have been definitely delving into this area. I know Jordan Peterson's very interested in sort of mythological ideas and the power of narrative and a whole lot of other stuff. I don't want to only focus on him. I mean, some might even say, some of Trump's advisors, but Steve Bannon is also.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
So can you just lay it out for us, you know, this supposedly anti-Western intellectual movement? Because, I mean, wouldn't it be the greatest irony if the West too were to participate in this? Because as you've described it in your article, this is supposedly an anti-Western intellectual movement everywhere else in the world. So shed some light on what's going on here, Anvesh. Thank you.
It's so curious, isn't it? I mean, I really think that in the Russian, Indian, and Chinese example, it is explicitly based on pushing back against the cultural dominance of the West. And then you look at these civilizational thinkers in your West, and you're wondering, what are you pushing back against? But I think the answer comes in you have to look at the contesting ideas of modernity that not only exist. Because in India, in China, in Russia, you can't say that everybody is a civilizational thinker. Not yet. In China, I agree that it's more of the party line. It's becoming more of the party line. So that's what we see. We don't see much of the dissent in China. But in places like India and Russia, there's a lot of dissent against civilizational thinking. It isn't necessarily the dominant paradigm yet. It's not necessarily the one that people are rebelling against. There's still liberal paradigms. There's still socialist paradigms. There's still, you know, in Russia, there's still democratic liberal thinkers who are very pro-West. In India, it's the same.
Sure.
So there's still a contestation of ideas that are happening within these societies. What I've looked at in terms of the civilizationalists are people who are trying to gain that dominant space within their own societies and then to reform and reshape their societies along these narrative lines. And it's not a partisan endeavor either. I've found civilizationalists, if you think it's a right-wing thing or a left-wing thing, you are wrong.
Okay, please.
Civilizationalism
explain that.
Goes beyond the left-right. It goes beyond the left-right binary. It goes beyond that. What they're trying to do is bring in a paradigm shift of thinking. And that is why the field is so fresh. It's still so new because they don't even have the vernacular. They don't even have the vocabulary to articulate their thinking yet. That's what they're doing. Right now, a lot of these civilizationalists, the reason that they are writing, the reason that they're out speaking, the reason that they are promoting their work to audiences is to begin massaging these ideas into the general public, to begin creating a vocabulary of civilizationalism that future thinkers, future politicians can begin to draw upon. It's still a very, very new field. It's not a left-right thing. So what I'm thinking of in the Western case of people like Jordan Peterson or Steve Bannon or people like this, and if you look at this, we can spend 50 podcasts talking about what happened during the Trump years, but if you want to look at some of the undercurrents that went into making the Trump phenomenon, they're not gone. They were there before Trump came, and they're still here after he's gone, but it's pushing back against this elitism, this one formal notion of official, you know, the elites telling people this is what your political future is going to be like. These are the models and thoughts and ideas that you should follow because we are telling you that these are a good thing and you should listen to us because we are smart. We went to Harvard and Yale and Oxford and Princeton, and we went to Delhi University, and then we went to Cambridge and all these things. And people are beginning to push back against that. I don't think that... I think what the reason that Trump was propelled so far is because people in the West, within these societies, for whatever reason, they were left behind by the dominant paradigm. They didn't see themselves represented in this liberal, democratic vision of the future. I can't speak to that, but it's something that is there. And I think what happens in our policy space all too often is that we don't tap into this ideation. We don't understand this resentment, this undercurrent, this frustration. And then suddenly it surprises us. suddenly we keep asking, oh, why, how could this right-wing person have won, an election or whatever? We keep getting shocked. I mean, Donald Trump, for all his faults, he was the second most voted for candidate in American political history for president after Joe Biden. So there are people who obviously liked what he was doing for the last 4 years. There's a sentiment, there's a narrative that he was selling to people that people identified with. And that identification is so strong. People don't vote based on policy. People aren't out marching on the street because of, you know, the marginal tax rate being raised from 13% to 18%. That's not what animates people. That's not what gets them to go and have these ideas and these notions that make them want to change the world. It is ideas. It is narratives. It is things that they can identify with. And I think that's what the civilizationalists are doing so well, not just in those other countries that we're talking about, but in the West. They're talking to a resentment and a frustration that has been bubbling up for decades. We've ignored it, and now we have to reckon with those consequences.
No, I think that's going to be a big challenge for people in policy, because that's going to really change, I guess, not just a shift in thinking, but a real openness to, you know, alternative voices.
You don't want to share a stage with these people. I get it. It's almost like a lowering of your own credentials. But we
a lot of people would view it that way. Exactly.
Yeah.
But so what would you say to, I guess, our colleagues? Yeah.
I don't know if I can speak to our colleagues, but I can speak to, I consider myself more of a student, more of a learner, a viewer of these things. I think you should get your information from all kinds of sources. And I think when you run into these people out in the world or in the street, so many people, their first reaction is to shut themselves off, to say, I don't want to be your friend. I don't want to even listen to what you have to say. I mean, I was in Berlin 2 weeks ago in front of the Bundestag, the German parliament, and there was an AfD, like a far right party voter who was protesting the German parliament. It ended up raining. I was stuck under a tree with him and I had a conversation with him and the conversation went fine. I didn't have any problem with that. But you can talk to these people. You can understand what animates them. Why are you doing this? What gets a person to walk 2 or 3 weeks from his hometown, and he has an audience on the app called Signal, which I didn't even know much about. He was saying that people are giving him donations, people are cheering him on. What gets a person to walk 3 weeks from their hometown to go protest in parliament and just stand there by himself with the German flag? These people are out there. They're in the world. We have to talk to them. We have to understand. We might not agree with them. I don't agree with so much of what they say, but we have to recognize that they are there. And in a democracy, they have an equal voice as you and I.
Yes. So,
we have to speak to them. If we're not speaking to them, we're losing.
Brilliant. No, that's a great point to make, and that's a great sort of a spirit to have, one of engagement. Advesh, I'd like to wind up our first part of this conversation by just talking a little bit about the idea of civilizations as a process.
Yes.
You're right, because I think this is very interesting. You write, quote, the purpose of the civilization, its calling, must be realized through its continuing existence as the civilization lives as long as the mandate is undelivered, and it dies after the mandate has been accomplished. Now, that last sentence, you were quoting another author there. So I find this very interesting. I always thought of civilizations in cyclical terms, but this frames it more as a linear progression. So I want to leave our listeners pondering this idea here of civilizational accomplishment. It seems that there is a neat comparison to be made with nation states. Nation states, or I should say nations, know when they've achieved statehood. For example, when they gain independence, there are tangible physical signs of this. You know, you get a flag, a currency, maybe some border posts are set up, you know, but how can a civilization track its progress? How does it know when it's reached its mandate?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this question. I was pondering this one because it's a good question, but it's a very tough one. And I think it's difficult even for the civilizationalists that we are studying, that we are talking to. I think it's difficult even for them to answer. And this is something that I saw again and again in the literature that they are putting out there in the world. I mean, the quote that you yourself got, it was from a book review of another book about individual rights in a civilization state, A New Idea of India. So it's showing that I found that book review so interesting because it's not something that we would access in formal academia. It's something I found on a Facebook forum, but it ended up having so many good concepts for the Indian example. And they talk about this. I don't know if one of the reasons that I was looking at this is because civilizationalism is a project. It is a process. And I don't think that process or project is one that they envision. They're not in the home stretch, you know? They are maybe 30 years. If we look at this from Huntington's time, they are 30 years into this project. If we look at it from the relative power decline of the United States, let's mark it with the presidency of Donald Trump, we're looking at a space of 5 years. These civilizationalists, they are in it for the long haul. They are looking at reforming and reshaping their societies, not on a basis of 5 years, 30 years, 50 years, but they are looking 200, 300 years into the future. And if let's just go with the Indian example. If it took 250, 300 years for the West to colonize India, it's going to take a heck of a lot more than 75 years to decolonize India. That is what these thinkers are saying. So they're looking at this as a project of 150, 200, 300 years, potentially. They're looking to really fundamentally reshape the currents of their societies. I don't know if they'll be successful. I don't think anybody can predict that far into the future. And I don't think even they understand what the physical manifestations of being a civilization will mean. Part of me believes that this quote, that the idea that the civilization dies after its mandate has been accomplished, means that this process of inquiry, it has to continue, that this tension, this agitation, it has to continue. Otherwise, the idea of civilizationalism itself dies. So civilizationalism is a constant process. It is a, I think in the Marxist vernacular, you would say it's the eternal or immortal revolution. You know, it's something that has to continue or else the idea, the movement dies. There's never a moment when they can rest and say, okay, we've done it. We are a civilization state. We have achieved civilizationalism. Everything in society is as it is to our liking because these are living societies. Mm. They continue. They have to be reproduced. One of the essential customs, one of the essential foundations of the civilizationalism phenomenon that I've researched is this idea that the civilization has to be reproduced. This is an integral concept. It cannot be one generation or five generations. It has to be 10 generations. It has to be in education. It has to be in the mythology. It has to be in the worldview of every citizen in these civilizations.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah.
And sorry, I'll continue real quick.
Please.
One of the things that I think you're seeing in this current stage of where these civilizational thinkers are at, a lot of them haven't come up with that idea of where they want to go, what the end state is. But I think that's a question that's on their minds. Mm. In that same book review that we've quoted from just now about the civilization lives as long as that mandate is undelivered, in that same book review on, I think it's swatantra.com, it's like an Indian literary site, I guess. But in it, they were espousing different concepts of what a future Indian civilization state could look like, because they were critiquing even the current literature. They were saying it's not enough to say that India is a civilization state or it's going to become a civilization state. We have to outline and articulate what that civilization state looks like. And I think there's going to be a contest or a tension in the ideas in the future, because right now, civilizationalists in these countries, they are a very broad coalition. I think in the Russian example, we saw about how many different factions have to come together across partisan lines to push the civilizational imaginary, the civilizational dimension or paradigm of thinking. And once this paradigm shift has been achieved, once it becomes the dominant discourse, you're going to be seeing a lot of different ideas about how that civilization state end state can be achieved. In the article in the book review just now, I think they were talking about a lot of concepts from the Vedas, from Hindu imaginary or Dharmic concepts, from Dharmic religion. They were talking about in the traditional Hinduism, there's four objects of human pursuit or purusharthas, and they're like economic prosperity. There's, you know, personal and physical pleasure. There's education. There's things like this, and they all fall within this kind of cosmic order. This is one of the things that they're talking about. So a lot of the civilizationalists right now, what they're trying to do is they're trying to come up with an episteme. They're trying to come up with a vocabulary that they can discuss. I think in the same book review, they talked about it as we must initiate or we must instigate a flowering of an authentic Indic episteme. So we have to create a whole knowledge system. We have to create a whole library of concepts, of vocabulary, of ideas along how we can reform and push our society towards what we think is the ultimate civilization state that is true to ourselves, true to our culture, true to our heritage, true to this ancient and contiguous notion of where the civilization that has existed for thousands of years, where is it going to be for the next 100? Where is it going to be for the next 1,000?
Yeah, well, it's incredible sort of time spans they're looking at there. And,
yeah,
you know, one would hope that when civilization reaches its zenith, that, you know, one could sort of enjoy it for a brief moment. I mean, I think
hopefully.
Even in... Yeah, hopefully. I mean, it is interesting. I mean, let's... oftentimes, I mean, you look at the Tang Dynasty in China, or you look at the golden age, you know, of Arabic science, and, you know, like the Renaissance, you know, it's so easy for us to look backwards and say, oh, those were the good old days, right? But let's even like bring it into a much shorter time span. I mean, a lot of Americans or Westerners more broadly would look at, say, but probably particularly the Americans, because they may not have had too much to rebuild from after the war as opposed to the Europeans. But let's stick with North America, would say, you know, the 50s depending on whether or not you want to bring in the 60s.
Make America a lot of great social again.
revolution. But in terms of the economic, prosperity and the baby boom and everything, that was great. And then the 90s, you know, you had a different sort of another, you know, the USSR had dissolved and you had this sort of end of history moment. It's kind of hard now we're in 2021, to sort of gauge whether or not people at that point really understood, that they were basically at the top of the mountain, you know. So it's an interesting concept.
I think so much of this civilizational inquiry, it depends on this idea that we were once great and we are now fallen.
Yeah.
And I think you can see that even in something as simple as four words, make America great again.
Yes.
When was America great? Who are we talking about? Who was it great for?
Yes, exactly.
I think all civilizationalists, they have to preoccupy themselves with this idea that we were once great, we are now fallen. We once had good times, but we are now living through bad times. And to be quite honest, I can't say I disagree with them in terms of, I think everybody around the world kind of feels it, that since the last 5, 6, maybe 10 years, since the 2008 recession, I don't think we're living in very good times. I think this is one of the reasons that you've seen civilizationalists be able to tap into this very repressed, very frustrated audience at home and around the world. It's because, I mean, we're sitting here living through a global pandemic that isn't even probably halfway over yet, looking at all the developing countries around the world that still need their vaccines, looking at all the events of the last few years, looking at how close we're edging day by day towards, you know, a clash of civilizations, perhaps, as Huntington would put it, this tension between the United States and China and all these places, all these conflicts that are beginning to break out, the liberal internationalist system that is beginning to unravel a little bit, the pandemic that we're living through. I think it's hard for a lot of people to say that now is the good times.
No, exactly.
I think it's the bad times for a lot of people, and civilizationists are saying, hey, stick with us, we can get you back to the good times.
It's fascinating stuff, Anvesh. Thank you so much for laying this out so well for our audience. I'm sure so many listeners would love to find out more about your work. We will have a second part of the episode where we will, right at the end, of course, discuss, where people can find you and everything like that. So fear not, you will be back with us shortly. So thank you so much. But just briefly, if you want to, share with us your Twitter, your LinkedIn or anything, where can people go, in the week between this part of the episode and the next part? Mm-hmm.
Liam, it's my utmost pleasure. I feel like it's a good thing we're doing a two-parter because we still have so much to discuss.
Yes.
Anybody who's listening, they can find me on LinkedIn, just Anvesh Jain, very simple. Just add me and I'll add you back. Otherwise, I do have a website, https://anveshjain.com. Very simple. I have all my publications. I have all my stuff on there. So please check it out. Give it a read. Let me know your thoughts.
It's a nice website as well. You've done it looks very slick. So congrats on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anvesh. Well, we'll be back next week for some more. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Liam.
If you enjoyed this conversation and would like to help the show, leaving us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts is the easiest way to do so. To give us a review, just go to Policy People on Apple Podcasts and hit Write a Review. Thank you for listening and for supporting our show.